This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Society in the U.S. is becoming more and more diverse. Colleges and universities are seeing many more immigrants, minorities, and first in family college students applying to and attending their institutions every semester. For those students and the entire school population, the Office of Diversity is becoming a staple of the modern college campus.
I had the opportunity to really work on changing the culture to make it easier for students to be successful.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll travel to Las Vegas, Nevada, and talk to someone who has created an Office of Diversity at universities on both sides of the country. We'll also hear how Jewish students are using their faith to become more social and spend an academic minute exploring the politics of the headscarf. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Barbie Oakes knows a lot about dealing with diversity on campus. Almost a decade ago, she established the first Office of Diversity at Wake Forest University in North Carolina. Last year, she moved across the country to the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, a very different and much more diverse school, and took on the same project. According to U.S. News and World Report's annual listing of the nation's most diverse universities for undergraduates, UNLV is tied for first in the publication's annual Best Ethnic Diversity listing. Barbie Oakes is now the university's chief diversity officer. On a visit to the UNLV campus, I spoke to Dr. Oakes about her role in setting up two diversity offices in two very different schools, starting with Wake Forest.
Yes, I did. I was the first chief diversity officer at Wake Forest, worked there for 28 years. Just in all the time I was there, from a faculty position until I became an administrator, really worked on a lot of these campus climate issues.
Tell us what it's like building an Office of Diversity.
It's really quite exciting. For 14 years at Wake Forest, I was the director of the Office of Multicultural Affairs, and my role really centered around helping students understand how to navigate the culture. And then when I became the chief diversity officer and the assistant provost, I had the opportunity to really work on changing the culture to make it easier for students to be successful so that the burden of responsibility is not so much on students, but we're really changing the culture. And so I actually helped to develop the first strategic plan for diversity and inclusion at Wake Forest and was really impressed with how easily the campus was willing to embrace our message when they were given a strategy for how to do so. So when the search firm contacted me about the position here, saying that this would be an inaugural chief diversity officer role, I thought it would be a great opportunity to come and see if I could really help build the same kind of a successful network here that I was able to do at Wake Forest.
Diversity in Wake Forest and diversity here at UNLV has to be two very different things.
Yes, it is very different. Wake Forest has predominantly 10% international students, probably close to 30% all students of racial and ethnic minority, but it's very much a predominantly white institution. And in addition, the socioeconomic status is dramatically different at Wake Forest compared to UNLV because more than 61% of the students don't get any financial aid, and the cost of attendance is quite substantial, more than $65,000 a year at Wake Forest. So very different students. Very academically gifted. A lot of them really know a lot about how to navigate the culture, but many of them do not have the same ability to embrace difference. I think that as students here at UNLV, where we have more than 70% of our students come from racial and ethnically diverse groups, but the income levels of the families is significantly lower. Here, 76% of our students get financial aid. 31% of the students at UNLV are also first generation. So completely different skill set in terms of how to navigate campus cultures, how to access resources. So we have to be a lot more proactive in terms of how we help foster their success. And so I think that where graduation was not as much of a challenge at a school like Wake Forest, just getting students to graduate is a big issue here at UNLV. And in addition to that, we do have to think about what kinds of resources do they need in addition to the curriculum to help them be successful. We also at UNLV have a significant, you know, percentage of undocumented students or students with limited immigration status. So there's a very different campus climate that we're dealing with here.
Is it a different job, too, when you have a campus like Wake Forest, which is a residential campus, as compared to a commuter campus like this?
Yes, that is another issue that we're dealing with. UNLV is a large urban research institution. We're an open campus, so we deal with issues of homeless individuals on our campus, but we also have students who are homeless. We have a significant number of students who have aged out of the foster care system, students that deal with issues like food insecurity on a regular basis. So that's, you know, student success is very different here. And so even building a strategy around diversity and inclusion is different because the majority of students are from diverse identities here. So then thinking about resource allocation has a different meaning here in terms of supporting diversity and inclusion than it did at Wake Forest because, you know, there most of the work was grounded in either race and ethnicity, sexual orientation and gender identity. But here we have a large veterans population in addition to, you know, a large number of our students deal with disabilities of all different types. So, yes, it is different. But just one other thing about the differences in a residential campus. Here, only about 2% of our students live on campus. So, the communication becomes a major issue at a school like this because how you get information to students and get information from students becomes much more of a challenge than it does in a residential community.
Usually on the news when you hear about a diversity officer, it's because an incident occurred. How much of the job is actual crisis management?
I would say that in many ways, a good portion of the job is not necessarily around crisis management, but navigating campus culture. For example, in the past year that I've been here, I worked very closely with our Associate Provost of Faculty Affairs and our Executive Director of Compliance because if an issue rises to the level of a compliance report, then that is beyond the scope of what I, as the Chief Diversity Officer, am able to manage individually. So what we're trying to work on within our campus culture is to begin to build communication channels and processes so that people can let us know whether they're students, whether they're faculty or staff. They can let us know when they're having issues that make them feel not included within the campus culture. If it's a case of students, you know, are there things that are happening systemically that make you feel that you don't belong here? The whole concept of belonging sounds so like one of these warm and fuzzy concepts, but in reality, one of the greatest keys to student success is whether or not we have created a campus culture that makes them feel that they belong. And so working on some of those kinds of issues, I think, is a major challenge that we have here. So that means that you are constantly meeting with people who either have questions or want to talk about climate issues so that we can address it and fix it. And sometimes it becomes a challenge for diversity officers because those are not situations and issues that you want to talk about publicly. But that's very important work. So I think that one of the biggest challenges for chief diversity officers is that we have to realize that many times the work that we do is not even known by people. And that's a sign that we're doing our job well, because it also means that we've created a culture where people trust us to bring their issues and their challenges. So I'm constantly working on the inside, both with people from diverse identities and also with the administration and the faculty and staff to help address those issues. So I think that one of the greatest asset that a chief diversity officer must have is diplomacy.
Is there a part of your job that would just surprise people thinking, really, that's something you do?
I think probably the amount of time that I spend building relationships might be a surprise to people. That's important for any diversity officer, because sometimes you see the ugliest side of human nature when you do this work. Other times you're celebrating remarkable successes, whether it's during a time of challenge or whether a time of celebration. If you have relationship with people, it's easier to keep building progress forward. And so I know that might sound unusual, but I think it's very important to build relationship because, see, you know, like at the very heart of inclusion is organizational trust. If you don't know people, you can't trust people. If you don't know people, you don't know how to make them feel included. And when they don't feel included, they don't trust you. And so trust building can only happen in the presence of relationship.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Barbie Oakes continues with a look at how last year's mass shootings at a Las Vegas music festival affected the UNLV campus. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Dr. Barbie Oakes, the Chief Diversity Officer at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Soon after Dr. Oakes arrived at UNLV last year, 58 people were killed and hundreds were injured when a gunman opened fire on the Route 91 Harvest Music Festival on the Las Vegas Strip. I asked Dr. Oakes if that tragedy had an effect on the campus. And a quick note, this conversation took place just a few days before the first anniversary of that shooting.
Oh, absolutely. When the massacre happened on 1 October, that night, our Thomas and Mack Athletic Center here on campus was used as a triage center. So we were physically right in the middle of it. They were busing. I think over 500 individuals spent the night at the Thomas and Mack Center that had been victims of the massacre there. And in addition, students, faculty, and staff were at the concert. Some were injured, seriously injured. I think two former students actually lost their life at the concert. And so that hit at the heart of this university. It was very traumatic. Our student affairs teams held, spaces for people to come in and grieve and express, you know, their grief, healing processes. We suspended classes for a certain amount of time and really offered opportunity to provide support to the community. So it was a time of tremendous bonding here, but also a time of extreme trauma. And so then from the perspective of administration, we're working to look at if students are unable to continue in school, making sure that they can withdraw without penalty. How do you navigate? So sometimes I think part of the challenge of doing this work is finding that balance between how much time you have to spend in the administration of it, logistics, policies, processes, resources, allocation, and then demonstrating the empathy and the concern that people need and having the time to build relationship with you so that they trust you when it occurs. So we're having a big celebration, a commemoration on campus on the 1st of October to just mark that date because it's changed our campus and our city forever.
You hadn't really been here very long when that happened, were you?
No, I had only been here literally 1 month. I started the 1st of September. The week that I first started my job was when we had the anti-DACA legislation. Then 2 weeks after that, we had 1 October. So it was, quite the entrance into the campus community. But I have just learned that in these times of crisis, that's when you can sometimes form the most meaningful relationships with people. So it very, very quickly cemented me as a member of the UNLV community, and people saw me as someone who was really concerned about the overall well-being of our campus. And so I guess just one other thing about that might be surprising about the work that we do is that there's always a tension between a chief diversity officer being seen as someone who only speaks on the behalf of the marginalized, underrepresented, underserved population. But I am just as committed to ensuring that the majority voice always feel that we're honoring free speech for them. And so the challenge is, how can we create a community where all these voices can coexist and that they can learn to actually talk to one another and listen to one another without having this us versus them mentality? So even when 1 October occurred, there were a lot of people who were very fearful of what that might mean for the Second Amendment rights. And we honored their ability to express their opinions, even when so many people were experiencing very real physical and emotional trauma because of gun violence. So that's some of the tension, I think, that we have to navigate in these conversations and in these spaces.
What didn't I ask you that people should know?
Two things. Student athletes are increasingly in the spotlight, the national narrative around these issues. So I think that we had to begin to think more about how we equip student athletes to be a voice. They're a student, they're an athlete, and now sometime they're expected to be a voice on these issues of social activism. So that's an area that has not received as much attention at college. And then secondly, having great relationships with the campus police and the Metropolitan Police is absolutely crucial to the success of the work that we do. We are not the enemies of the police, and we don't see the police as our enemies. There are sometimes tensions that occur, but we do work very closely and try to navigate those conversations when there is tension in order to help us to build better models of community policing on our college campuses.
Dr. Barbie Oakes is the Chief Diversity Officer at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. My thanks to the Education Writers Association for granting us a scholarship to attend their higher education seminar this September at UNLV. For many young adults, college is a vital time in developing connections to their beliefs. Some even say it's a make-or-break time in their religious lives. This is true for many faiths, in particular, Judaism. But as Emily Adelman reports, young Jews might not be spending their college years spending a lot of time at services, but it is the time they're embracing their heritage in other ways.
Syracuse University student Adam Unger doesn't think he looks Jewish.
Not 100% sure if people can tell. You know, I have dark brown hair and brown eyes, so, like, in that sense, I'm far from Hitler's dream. I wouldn't say so.
Standing 5 feet, 10 inches tall, with a backpack wrapped around one shoulder, he looks like a typical college sophomore. But he is, in fact, Jewish, one of many at Syracuse University. While he may not look Jewish, he spends a lot of time talking about and learning about his culture. He is enrolled in Hebrew classes and goes to the school's Jewish Hillel group every week, but not for services. No, he plays pool, watches movies, and is even part of the organization's fantasy football league.
I think the cultural aspect of Judaism is more important than the actual religious aspect of Judaism. And I think the cultural aspect is a lot harder to break than the religious aspect is.
For Syracuse Hillel Vice President Allison Epstein, it is important for people to realize that Judaism is not always about the religion itself. The majority of the time, it is hanging out with people who make you feel comfortable.
Most of the time when I'm there, I'm just being around Jewish people. I'm not practicing religion. It's just, you know, kind of a safe place where I feel comfortable with other people who are like me. You know, it's not to discuss our views on God and heaven and if hell is a real place or anything like that. It's to be around people who are like me.
Epstein realizes that many times people put the Jewish faith in a box, and the junior feels that's much too narrow.
You know, a lot of people define Judaism as just a religion, as a way of practicing what they believe in, but it's so much more.
And that happens with any religion, with Christianity, Islam, and others. But Judaism is more than a religion. It is an organization. It is a family, especially in college, where young adults are more prone to being dismissed for who they are, no matter what religion, ethnicity, or race. That's why Adam loves being in college. The way others of his religion immerse themselves in all kinds of aspects of his faith, it reminds him of home.
My identity revolves around, you know, the cooking culture, because Jewish food is amazing, and summer camp, because I just didn't really have much of a Jewish community at home, but that makes me appreciate it more when I can find it elsewhere, like at a summer camp or at school.
Adam has heard every stereotype there is about people who are Jewish, but these days, he just laughs it off. He says that anywhere he goes where people know he's a Jew, it will happen. He realizes that Jewish stereotypes are a part of life, and he doesn't really mind them anymore, because he is proud of his roots.
The people who know me know that I am and know how much it means to me.
College is a time of choice. Jews on campus can choose whether they participate in traditional religious activities and whether to fight the stereotypes and embrace their culture. College is a place where students learn and grow. It's a time of learning. Through that learning, much of it outside of the classroom, students can embrace their cultures in ways that last weeks, years, and sometimes even a lifetime. I'm Emily Edelman.
A Muslim woman wearing a headscarf in the U.S. can be seen as a political rather than a religious statement. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
The headscarf worn by some Muslim women is becoming a tool of civic engagement. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Aubrey Westfall, assistant professor of political science at Wheaton College, explains why wearing a religious symbol freely is an important step in self-expression.
For the last 6 years, I have been engaged in a collaborative research project studying the social and political significance of the headscarf among Muslim women in the United States. Nearly 2,000 survey respondents from 49 states offered my co-authors and I their insights on the wearing and perception of the headscarf, and about 70 Muslim women in 17 focus groups provided valuable details about their personal experiences wearing the headscarf in the United States. The experiences of those interviewed, most of whom were U.S. citizens, often ran counter to popular conceptions. For example, while there is a common assumption among some Americans that Muslim women are forced to wear the headscarf, an overwhelming majority of our respondents revealed that they chose to do so as an expression of personal and collective religious and cultural identity, and as an exercise of their civil liberties. The headscarf, primarily a religious symbol, is increasingly becoming a self-styled tool of civil engagement. It is viewed by many wearers as a means by which to claim their Americanness and their religious freedom. The discussions provided a better understanding of the sense of citizenship and belonging among these women and how they are engaged in citizenship in the United States. It also shed some light on the role of mosques and religious communities in promoting positive political engagement. Our conversations also revealed troubling experiences of frequent discrimination and even occasional violence against covered women. Despite this hostility, the degree to which these women are engaging in productive citizenship in their mosques and communities is significant. These women, therefore, embody a contradiction. They experience a sense of precarious membership in American society while simultaneously enjoying full legal protection of their religious practice and asserting their identity as full and active citizens.
That was Aubrey Westfall of Wheaton College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.